Welcome to China Tech Talk, the almost weekly discussion of technology and startups here in China. I am John Artman, editor-in-chief of techno.com, joined as always by Matthew Brennan, founder of China Channel. So before we get into this week's discussion, which I'm very excited to be bringing to you guys, I just want to give a quick shout out to TechNode Squared, our membership program that we launched a few months ago. And so if you go to technode.com, you'll find that pretty soon there's going to be a paywall. So if you're listening to this, there might actually be a paywall up already, which means that some of our premium content is unavailable if you are not a member. So I don't want to talk about it too much, but I'll just leave it there. And actually what I'm super excited for as well is the 2019 edition of China Chat. And so this is Matthew's conference. Matt, how long have you been doing it now?
This is the fourth year now.
It's the fourth year. And so, you know, I've been going to a lot of conferences recently, and we're going to be recording an episode which might actually be released before this episode. So sorry for the confusion there. We're going to be talking about conferences and some of our experience and things like that. So if you've missed it, make sure you listen to it. But China Chat is one of those conferences that I've always enjoyed going to. I've been to it 2 years now. I mean, for me, and this is why I think that Matt and I, we get along so well and we have good chemistry, is because we're both, at the end of the day, very much about content and about quality content. And that's what I love about China Chat, because Matt, you know, you have the presentations in the afternoon, which is chock full of really good data, and you get some really good speakers, very knowledgeable. But then in the morning, you have the workshops. And this is actually a model that that we adapted a little bit for our Emerge event that we had in May, because it would just work so well for what you guys do. So Matt, any information you can share preliminarily about what we can expect?
Yeah, China Chat, 4 years. It's 4 years running, and the format hasn't changed. And this year, like you say, lots of workshops and keynotes. We try and bring together anything around WeChat marketing, and then sort of general China digital marketing as well, adjacent areas, KOL marketing, other platforms like Douyin, Weibo, things like that. It's all in there. 2 days, after parties, pre-events, after events. We try and pack everything in. So it's like, because a lot of people do travel in for it, right? So we get people coming into Shanghai just for this event.
And that'll be in
September. It's almost exactly the same as last year in terms of it. But this year it's 19th and 20th, Thursday, Friday.
Okay. And are you still using the same venue?
Yeah, we use the same venue. It's a great venue. Rooftop garden, and it's like if the weather's nice, which it usually is, I think it's been nice almost every year. It's a really, really nice venue, and it's quite convenient downtown. It's difficult to find a venue that's actually central like that. It's like not way out there. You can get to it fairly easily. Yeah, all good.
Cool. All right, so that's the end of the promo stuff, and I am very excited to be bringing you guys this episode this week. We are talking with Rio from the Crazy Capital podcast. And you know, this was a guest that Matt was really kind of pushing to come on. I say pushing, there wasn't much of a resistance from me, but you know, Matt, you discovered his podcast. You've been listening to it, and I have to say that this is one of my favorite episodes. I probably say that quite often after we do a recording, but this is literally one of my favorite episodes, top five, just because, you know, we're able to talk with someone who's almost like a mirror image of what we're doing, in a sense, where he's creating a quote unquote real podcast, but he's Chinese and he's doing it in Chinese for the Chinese language market.
Yeah, exactly. There is some eerie similarities there, but Rio, which I imagine our listener base to this podcast probably never heard of Rio before, right? Because everything he does is in Chinese language, right? So for the majority of listeners, I guess you probably haven't heard of Rio, but trust us, the guy's very knowledgeable and has done very many interesting things online, like with platforms like Juhl, and with running not just one, but several podcasts. And is also an early stage, what's in early stage VC as well, based in Shenzhen. So Rio is super knowledgeable, and I've personally, I'm like, having listened to his stuff for quite a while now, I'm really excited to have him on the podcast. So kind of trust us that, you know, this podcast is going to be mostly about podcasting, which is a little bit meta. But I think the more interesting stuff that we cover at the end, particularly, is about, you know, why the China market's different, right? What are the driving factors behind the China market and, say, the US or the Western market in terms of the internet and in terms of audio content?
Exactly. And that's the great thing, because, you know, we're international facing, he's China facing, but we have a very similar approach to how we create content and just kind of the areas that we look at. So again, I really enjoyed this episode, and I hope that everyone else will as well. And with that, we give you Rio. All right. Well, Rio, thanks so much for taking the time to join us today.
It's nice to be here. Thank you, guys.
So usually we ask our guests, you know, what's your China story? But that's kind of a bit of a redundant question in a certain sense, for you. So could you just give us a brief introduction, you know, a brief introduction to yourself and what people know you for, and also tell us a little bit about, you know, what you do and what keeps you busy on a day-to-day basis?
Okay. I am Rio. That's the name I'm known for. Right now, I work at a small tech venture firm in China, mostly investing in early stage startups in China, tech related. I am probably best known for my podcasts, plural forms, because I have several. I've been podcasting since 2013, so it's about 6 years now. The best or most famous show so far probably is called IT 公论. That's the oldest shows I have. Right now, I have three active podcasts, Crazy Capital, Feng Tou Quan, Kernel Panic, Nei He Kong Huang, which is, geared for, programmers and developers in China. And, a new show, by, a new partner of mine, called Pritrol, which we talk about tech and society in general.
And so what's your background? Like, what were you, so you said that you're like, so your day job, mm-hmm. let's call it, that's early stage VC.
Yeah.
But tell us a little bit more about that. And how did you come into that?
All right. Actually, my first job is at the Zhihu, the Quora like, social, question and answer website. In its early years, and that was a time Zhihu was incubating at Innovation Works, Changxin Gongchang, led by Dr. Kai-Fu Lee, which is famous for you probably know him. I've been there in Beijing for a couple of years. After that, I went to Canada to continue my study before returning to China to start my current venture firm in 2015. So I kind of get out in and off China.
So with Zhihu, right? Like, you were like, mm-hmm. you've actually got quite a big following on Zhihu, Rio, right? Like,
you're, oh yeah.
Like,
because the founders of Zhihu are actually close friends of mine during an even earlier project called Apple for Us. It's kind of like a group blog. It's kind of ancient term right now. Mm-hmm. A group blog during the early 2000s that focusing on Apple. I think in that time, Apple is still like a very niche product, very expensive in China right now, during that time. And I used to talk with the group, and I actually involved in maintaining the writing articles of the group blogs. And then several of the members later on went on to started their own companies, Zhihu, and also Wang Xing of Meituan is in that group. And, what's it called? Wan Doujia. I'm not sure. What's it? Does he has an English name? I'm not sure.
No, I don't think so. But it's
WonderJar is
like an app store for
It's like the before Android. The app store for Android app store, basically. Mm-hmm. Wang Junyi and the founder of WonderJar is also in that group. So it's kind of like the core internet startup people in that group. So when Zhihu started during their alpha test, I was I think my user ID number is like 24 something. So it's quite early. And I got to be a heavy user of Zhihu, writing answers on it, and got a huge follower during its booming years.
Right. So an online influencer as well. Yeah. Booming years. I mean, Zhihu started in what, 2010?
Late 2010 and 2011.
Right. Yeah. So about the same time as WeChat, actually, around that sort of like takeoff of mobile.
Yeah. That's in China. That's the start of the China mobile stage, I guess.
Okay. So, yeah, you do a couple of podcasts. So we want to, one of the reasons I wanted to bring you on here is because, firstly, I listen to your podcast. They're quite good. I enjoy it. Personally, I like listening to them, especially Feng Tou Quan, which is your sort of VC-focused podcast, I guess, in terms of content. And then, so like with these different podcasts that you do, like what's the position? So you've mentioned a couple of ones already, right? Broadly, what's the sort of target audience that you have, and like why podcasts? You know, why, because you know, that in the States, that would be kind of a bit of a silly question, right? But in the China market, I don't think it is, right? Why did you start in this area of doing podcasts for the China market?
Well, that was quite a long story, actually. Like I mentioned before, I started to produce my own podcast since 2013. That was the IT Gonglun, right? And so I actually got quite good at it, because at its peak, I think we got hundreds of thousands of listeners for that show. And then when I came back to China to start my venture firm, I think, well, why not have a show about the things I'm working on, right? Because I like to talk to people. Well, being a tech, early stage tech VC is mostly about talking to people, insiders, colleagues, and people that in the industry, right? So the primary reason I started Feng Tou Quan, its English name is called Crazy Capital, is that I wanted to know that what other people are doing in the tech VC industry, or in the VC industry in general in China, because I just came back since spending a couple of years abroad studying, not actually in China. So I wanted to know what's the story here, right? So I started the Crazy Capital so I can talk to different people and see what's their opinions, what's their thought about China in general. So that's the background story.
So it's more like a hobby and interest reason, yeah.
Also, part of the inspiration is the Andreessen Horowitz podcast. I think this started around 2013 or 14, I'm not sure the exact time. I listened to their shows regularly, and I like their quality. But during that time, not unlike now, they have like a China-focused team. But during that time, they do not actually talk about China a lot. So I thought, well, it would be nice if I have a Chinese language show talking about similar stuff. That would be quite interesting, right? So that's another kind of inspiration of the show.
And so, I mean, how would you describe your audience? I mean, what's your positioning with these various podcasts, and who would you say listens, mm-hmm. or what type of person listens to them?
Mm-hmm. Actually, originally, I thought the audience would be probably people like young investment managers and people working in the venture capital industry in China. But actually, it turns out to be much broader than I originally expected, because Crazy Capital, we've organized several offline meetups, and I actually did a survey of the background of the people attending, and I found that many are from the tech industry, like internet companies, financial sectors, college students, and even people, and also the people who want to start their own startups. So it turns out to be much broader than I thought.
Yeah, you guys do offline meetups. You have like a paid group as well on like there's a platform in China called Zhuxi Xingqiu, right? Like
yes,
you can pay a one-off fee and be part of a sort of exclusive group of listeners around the podcast. And you also got like other channels where you promote and everything like that. So yeah. I think there's quite a community around it, right?
Yes. We have over a thousand paying members. We call them members on Zhuxi Xingqiu, which is kind of like a forum that you can create like a private forum that people can join. And then you can have like a closed discussion because many of the topics and things we share are not probably appropriate to share it publicly. And I don't want the noise from the general public because as the internet population in China grows to probably cover over 3/4 of the population right now, there are lots of we call gangjing people that or trolls in English. I don't want that. So I want to have like a closed core audience that we can discuss things in depth without worrying too much about the repercussions of trolls and the spreading of the information because we're exploring interesting ideas and some of them are probably incorrect, turns out, right? So I want to limit the scope of the influence. But
when did you start that?
The group?
Yeah.
I think we started a group about 2 years ago, if I remember correctly.
Okay. So this is one of the really interesting things, I think about having you on. And, you know, coming, you know, for me as a media entrepreneur, mm-hmm. being able to talk with you as someone who, you know, VC entrepreneur, but it's also very involved in the kind of content and media space. Because, I mean, so we have a bunch of questions around kind of podcasting and things like that, but I just wanted to comment just really quickly about this group that you're doing, because it seems like there's a very similar phenomenon in the Western internet. And that's one of the things that, you know, we pay attention to very, very closely because mm-hmm. for our English website, you know, most of our readers are coming from outside of China. Mm-hmm. And so there seems to be this in the West, there's this movement more and more towards private forums,
newsletters, right?
Newsletters, Slack groups, invite only Telegram groups, yeah. And things like that. There was this this great article that I read a couple months ago, and I'll find it and I'll put it in the show notes. But basically, describing this movement, and again, only just for the Western internet, but describing this kind of evolution as the dark forest of the internet, where mm-hmm. again, just more and more stuff is kind of escaping from all the nonsense of the public internet mm-hmm. and going more and more towards the private internet. And so the reason I say that is because, you know, we're seeing this in the West. And so it's really interesting to hear you talk about something that in effect is actually very, very similar, mm-hmm. you know, because you want to get away from the trolls, you want to get away from the nonsense, and you want to be able to create a safe space where people can actually discuss things without having to worry about, you know, people intentionally trolling them or in trying to, you know, misconstrue what they're saying and get them in trouble or anything like that.
Yeah. I think that's a global phenomenon right now, if you really think about it. In the early stages of internet, we do not worry about that thing. If you look at all the infrastructure of internet right now, it's all kind of with the assumption that it's going to be used by a few elite of the population, so that people with educated background, that people know that stuff, they are polite. But as the usage of internet grows, we have to cover the majority of the population. Then you can't actually bolt on the old infrastructure with the old assumption and make it work towards the much broader population. I think this is a similar thing we see that in Facebook, in Zhihu, right, and in WeChat groups, it's all getting private and closed circles. And that's probably the natural tendency for people to manage the signal versus noise ratio, and also to get a little bit of privacy, because, well, hopefully our talk will be in a small private group will be forgotten relatively quickly than something permanent, say on a blog or website or something.
Yeah, and I think it mirrors kind of just communication, you know, offline communication networks in general.
Yeah.
Where, you know, you have historically, you know, you've had like public places where people get together and discuss the latest happenings, exchange gossip and things like that. But then they go home or they go to a friend's house or whatever, and they have their own kind of private discussions with people that they trust, is kind of what it comes down to.
Yeah.
But so I think, I mean, you know, when Matt pitched you as coming on the show, I did a bit of research, and I was actually really surprised to find you guys actually distribute on iTunes and other kind of international podcasting platforms. And I say that because, you know, I think that the state of podcasting in the mainland versus, you know, Western markets, it's actually quite different where, you know, Connie Chan, I think she kind of muddied the waters a little bit. No complaint against her necessarily. I think it was a useful heuristic for people outside of China, but, you know, she kind of categorized a lot of the paid content, a lot of, like, was it the Luo Ji Si Wei, that kind of stuff that you see on like Himalaya or Lijer or other, some of these other platforms, she kind of grouped that into podcasting, and it's not really podcasting in the traditional sense of the word, where it's someone's recording audio and then they're uploading that audio to a server and then using RSS to distribute throughout the internet. And so in China, you know, kind of the audio content model is in general quite different from that in the West. And so, like I said, I mean, it was really interesting to see that, number one, you're doing what I consider to be a quote unquote real podcast. Number two, that you're actually distributing it through kind of more typically associated with Western platforms and Western users.
Yeah. Well, actually, it's both by accident and by choice. So when I started in 2013, podcasting, what gets to the top three players right now in China, the audio platforms, we say, Himalaya, Liji, and this stuff, they are also getting started during that time anyway. So their infrastructure, their support is kind of not what we wanted. And to be honest, I don't want to be dependent on a third-party platforms, probably other than Apple, because Apple is controlling the majority of the podcast discovery and distribution anyway, right? So we keep doing that afterwards because actually due to practical concerns is that it's kind of difficult for a small team. Basically, we have like two people doing the shows. We don't have like a team working for me. It's difficult to actually manage publishing to those platforms, which this is kind of very different from what we call a multi-channel network concept right now, that you have like, say, a short video or something that you're going to publish on YouTube, Youku, or Bilibili, the different kind of video platforms. It's kind of different story there, right? Because we don't have the manpower to manage those. So I just want to keep it simple. And that platform out of the question, and I want a direct relationship with my audience. So we stick to the traditional RSS feed approach that is distributed and discovered during the Apple's iTunes catalog.
Which I think is great. I mean, honestly, I'm a huge fan of RSS. There's actually a podcast that I listen to. It's like one of the only podcasts that I've listened to for as long as I have.
Yeah.
It's called the No Agenda Podcast. And, you know, so just a word of warning, if you do choose to listen to it, it's a bit wacky. But one of the co-hosts, Adam Curry, along with Dave Weiner, if I remember his name correctly, they basically started podcasting. And so Dave Weiner is the guy who created and continues to advocate RSS,
yep.
whereas Adam Curry really kind of came up with the concept of the podcast, of something that like just downloads automatically and things like that. And so, you know, for me, RSS has always been my go-to ever since like Google Reader and then of course, podcasting and things. And so I'm just glad to hear you say that. So I guess, I mean, like, how would you describe the state of podcasting in mainland China these days, mm-hmm. especially compared to the US or Western markets?
Yeah. Actually, I think you said it earlier that you do not consider the majority of the podcasts in China actual podcasts. I tend to agree because, well, there are two sides of the stories. So first of all, I think in spirit, what we consider podcasts is quite different from what's on Himalaya and Legion and those major platforms, because podcasts as a concept is still to this day quite a foreign and niche, and only probably known by a few internet elites and old hands like me. But the vast majority of the new internet population in China, especially people getting on the internet through a mobile phone instead of PC, they don't have any. They cannot distinguish the podcast we mentioned and then the shows on Himalaya, right? So this is a hard thing to get through. The discovery is not there, because if you really think about it, what's the way to find my shows? Well, you have to be on Apple device to install the podcast app and then try to find the shows in the catalog, which I guess many people don't do that. Compare that to the budget, the advertisement budget, marketing budget spent by Himalaya and Liji. Well, Himalaya used to do like a whole subway show. They paint the whole subway station with their ads, and so people get to download their app and start listening, and they do have a much better UI, or probably not better, more tailored to the mainland China audience. Well, they naturally get more traffic, but the amateurish shows like ours, they do not have the budget to do anything like that. So we're kind of like more natural growth of audience and through word of mouth, and that's the major difference.
Just one quick question. I want to butt in here just for a second, because so I'm just curious about your personal opinion about some of the audio content.
Oh, yeah.
Do you listen to much Chinese audio content on these platforms, and kind of what's your general opinion of some of the stuff that you find there?
To be honest, I don't actually have any of those platforms apps installed. Yeah, most of my listening are through the Apple's built-in podcast network. So I have subscribed to a few shows, and the majority of them are English shows from the States, and a couple of shows for Chinese language shows are also friends I know. So. Because I don't think I'm in the same audience of those on those platforms.
Yeah, but some of that, I mean, to clarify for the listeners who are less familiar, right? So the sort of content on these platforms is heavily weighted. Well, firstly, audio content in China seems like Himalaya, like in English, is the leader in this sort of audio content market. There's other big names in there, like Duodao, which is an app that's a platform rather that's led by Lord Ji Siwei, which is like a big online influencer for learning content. And a lot of the content on these platforms is based around education, right? It's based around lectures, famous scholars, self-study courses, and that sort of leads into a sort of business model where it's built around paid content, right? Where you'll buy a course, or you'll buy a subscription to a platform in order to get this sort of learning content. And whereas a podcast usually has a more sort of an entertainment value or a sort of conversational element to it. Certainly, you know, your podcast, Rio, I think have that, and certainly ours do as well. This kind of content is more serious, perhaps you could say, and certainly built around achieving a certain educational goal, fulfilling a sort of gap of knowledge. Is my characterization there, is that how you would describe it as well, Rio? Is anything you...
Yeah, I think you described it pretty accurately. Most of the audio content in China are actually, compared to the States, they are more polished and professional produced, I guess, because their goal is to actually make money, right? So our amateurish, the quote unquote real podcasts are less about making money, because we can't. That's the unfortunate side effect. But the goal of them are quite different, because of those paid content, they want to make money. So they have to create kind of like, they have to find some, what you call the pain points of the population, of the courses and learnings and self-studies, is probably to fix the problem that people are nervous about the fast growth of the society, because they are afraid they cannot keep up. They want to have some kind of talking material when they want to talk to people. Otherwise, they will show they are kind of less educated and less social status. I think many of the contents are built to satisfy those needs. But I actually don't like those, because I think most of them are pretty shallow. Because really, if you think about it, what can you learn from a audio program that's usually less than 20 minutes in length, and you are supposed to get a college level degree out of it? I kind of doubt it.
Yeah, I think that I think in terms of personal preference, Rio, you and I are very much on the same page. And every once in a while, you know, I'll hear someone listening to some of the content on Himalaya or other platforms. Mm-hmm. And, you know, as someone who used to do radio, I did radio for about five years. And I say this, and what I'm about to say, I say it because it used to be me, that I really don't like talking heads or professional commentators, because, you know, at least judging from my own experience, when, in effect, as a radio host discussing certain topics, that's kind of what I ended up being, you know, where you just kind of slap together some research right before you go on air, and then you speak with authority as if you actually are an expert when you're not. You know, listening to some of this stuff, it's just like I'm listening to it in Chinese, and like, you know, I think part of it, this might sound horrible, but part of it, I think there is somehow a tendency in Chinese culture to, some people can just talk for forever. Mm-hmm. It's really just kind of what it comes down to. And so I'm listening to this stuff, like not like kind of eavesdropping in on it and stuff like that. And I'm listening to someone talk on and on and on for like 5 minutes straight. And I'm just thinking to myself, how is this person credible? You know, like, how is this person, does this person actually understand what they're saying? Mm-hmm. Or are they just, you know, saying the words? Does that make sense?
Yeah, that's true, because especially radio in China is very different, according to my understanding, that it's very different from the States, because radio as the broadcast media is heavily regulated and state controlled, right? So like, say, you can't just do your own radio show. That would be illegal in China. Since podcasts give us this opportunity to produce our own shows, well, you see lots of people doing things that are really interesting and they know a lot about, versus during the state controlled radio station that you have fixed number of hosts, maybe occasionally some kind of guests that want to talk about general subject. Right now, during the podcast, you have the opportunity to have as many shows as possible. So it's quite different kind of like a landscape here.
Yeah, I see like there's some parallels here between audio content and the internet in general. Whereas like in China, things are more sort of walled gardens, right? It's very much, especially in the mobile era, an app economy, right? Where content is within these walled gardens, whether it's Weibo, whether it's WeChat, whether it's Jinri Toutiao, whatever, right? and the platforms sort of dominate the algorithms and surfacing that content and sort of intermediate that relationship with the user. Whereas in the West, a lot more is on the open web. A lot more is like driven by Google search, where yes. People will go to Google to find content, type into that search bar. And the yes. open web is driven mostly by sort of more open standards. And so you've got a lot of different blogs and sources of content. And so for audio, mostly in the US market and Western markets, where podcasting is a bit more like the open web, right? Like there's an RSS standard, and it's a bit like blogging used to be, but it's perhaps even behind that because there's really not too many successful business models around podcasting audio content. I think that is changing. Definitely moves. Spotify is trying to move into this space, and it's quite clear they've got plans to do stuff. And I think Apple's taking it a bit more seriously recently. And maybe that's because, as 4G to 5G and also things like AirPods as well make listening a much better experience.
Mm-hmm. But you mentioned that the term open web, which has kind of got to me really, it's an interesting topic because I think open web is actually dead in China.
Yeah. Oh, sure. Yeah, totally. Yeah,
so when we compare the most of the podcasts and actually independent blogs, the situation is quite different in China and the US because I think it's in the early 2010s, China passed a law that basically eliminate personal blogs, personal websites, because you have to get a license and requirements, and those licenses are not actually available to individuals for quite a long time. I'm not sure if they actually lifted that restriction, but it's been there for quite a while. And during the same period, we see the rise of the platforms, especially Weibo, WeChat, and then for the audio, we have Himalaya and Legion stuff. RSS feeds, which is kind of a byproduct of personal blogs, is pretty much a foreign concept in China right now because, what is RSS? You can't even have a proper Chinese name for it. And because of that, law and, the development after that, China internet is basically controlled by a few large internet companies, which are listed in the US stock market somehow. But the US, because of its more kind of market-driven approach, we still see the open web there, but I think it's also dying. We see the closing down of Google Reader that kills a lot of personal blog because of the readers.
I was so disappointed by that.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, but that also signals the end of the golden age years of personal blogs. And after that, we see the rise of platforms like Medium, right?
Yes.
Yeah. But fortunately, in the U.S., because of the less government regulation there, we still have very good infrastructure to support actually personal blogs and audio content. For example, most of the commercial blog hosting companies like WordPress or Squarespace, those big names, they have the option to enable you to turn a blog into a podcast show because they share the same RSS feed, right? Those things does not exist in China anymore. Like, I don't think there's even a blog hosting provider in China now. Like, Blogbus, probably based in Shanghai, I think, closed down a few years ago because of the tightened restrictions. So that's the hosting part. And also the audio is kind of different than content. So audio has a kind of, the audio file usually measures in hundreds of gigabytes per hour, right? So you need some kind of bandwidth to support that. Bandwidth in China is notoriously expensive compared in the States. And nobody actually to provide free bandwidth for you. Compared to the States, we have like audio hosting providers like Libsyn and even Squarespace. They promise not free actually. So they offer unlimited bandwidth if you pay like $35 a month. you have no such infrastructure in China anymore. So if you want to start independent audio podcast, it's nearly impossible, right? So the only choice if you want to do that in China is to get on Himalaya and Legion platforms like that, and then get to accept their terms of services and their curation and then regulation. So it's quite sad.
Well, this is what's always so interesting for me, kind of looking at the difference between my home country, the United States, and my, let's say, adopted home country, China, is that on the one hand, so while the government in China has become very restrictive around the open web, let's call it, and in general, there's been a shift towards increased walled gardens, ecosystems that companies can control, and then of course monetize on. But it's funny because even you actually see something very similar happening in the U.S. right, where you're right. I mean, like, there is WordPress, there is Squarespace, and so if people want to do that, they can. But with things like Facebook and Instagram and Twitter and other kind of niche social networks, blogging is kind of, I mean, YouTube as well, right? Vlogging and all that kinds of stuff. It is in effect centralized, even though the government, you know, has had taken a very light hand when it comes to regulating the internet industry. And so it's always kind of interesting because you were talking about blogs before, and, you know, like TechCrunch, I think, is a really interesting example. And, you know, full disclosure, TechNote is China partners with TechCrunch. And I'm not trying to promote them, but I think it's a really good example, right? Because so Michael Arrington got started as any blogger did, you know, back in like, you know, 2006, 2007, that time frame. You know, he's a guy that was active in Silicon Valley, doing early stage investment, doing angel investment and things like that. And he just notices all the BS and he's like, hey, someone needs to be, you know, writing about this. And so he does. And it's interesting because, like, these days, like, if you look at TechCrunch, like, there's absolutely no trace of its history. And, like, Michael Arrington, he doesn't publish very often. He's not really much of a public figure anymore. But, like, back in the day, like, this guy was super controversial. You know, like, he blew the lid off of, you know, a bunch of kind of insider trading, investor conspiracy kinds of things. And, you know, and he had very strong opinions, and he's a very, uncouth, I think is a good way to put it. So very, very, very disagreeable, very willing to get into a fight, very, very, very willing to be controversial. And then, you know, it starts to gain traction. He's able to hire some more writers. And then slowly but surely it gets bought by AOL, and it slowly but surely turns into something that resembles, but not quite, a bit more of a traditional media. And so it's one of those things where it got started off as part of this decentralized movement of people taking advantage of the open web, and through network effect, it's actually relatively, like, the media space in the US, even online, is still relatively centralized. You know, you look at, like, the top five sites, it's going to be TechCrunch, Vox, The Verge, you know, 538, and maybe some others that I can't even think about. NPR, you know, New York Times, you know, this is the thing. And so, like, the point is that even without government intervention, there is this kind of movement towards centralization. Mm-hmm. Now, the thing is, in the United States and in the West in general, or the U.S. in particular, because so far the government has taken a relatively light hand in terms of regulation, there's still that possibility of something coming up and decentralizing some of this. But at the end of the day, you know, when people look at technology and more people are using technology, well, they don't get it. They don't understand how it actually works, and they're not interested in how it works, and they just want to use it. And so it's kind of interesting because of that, there is this, like I said, tendency towards centralization, mostly due to network effects.
I don't think it's necessarily evil. I mean, centralization is not necessarily evil. It's actually the natural outcome of competition, right? If you think about it, if you have a centralized walled garden, you can provide better user experience, especially on mobile, where people are more restricted on their interaction with the computer, right? So those platforms can offer very good user experience versus open web is kind of nightmare right now. Also, if you look at the cost structure, it's actually cheaper to run those things because you don't have to worry. For example, if you want to publish a podcast, you just throw it on Himalaya and you can let them handle the rest of it. Versus what I do right now, I have to host, find my own host, upload my own audio and find a place for it. And then, do all the kinds of tech stuff to support it. It's not actually adding that much value to the listening experience. It's just necessary to keep the thing running. And, discovery is much better on those centralized platforms because they do have people working, a whole team of people working actively to promote the platform and to promote the shows. And on the, for example, on media is to promote the content. We have kind of big names on it there versus a personal blog post, a blog or personal podcast. Well, what do you get? Right. So if you look at the competition, the natural forces are definitely geared towards the centralized players. So I don't see any other way out.
Yeah. And the mobile itself just lends the mobile experience with the small screen in your pocket lends itself to apps, right? Like apps are what works on phones. The starting point for content discovery is the Google search box, like on the desktop, but on the phone, it would be the App Store or the apps that you already have installed. So that dynamic, I think the shift to mobile just speeds up this whole natural sort of centralization process a lot. And for China, especially, like, there's the aspect of, yeah, it's dominated by these big platforms, and these platforms. So we don't see this sort of we don't see these dominant platforms around podcasting, apart from Apple, which has kind of ignored it, kind of mostly, right? Like,
yeah.
Even though they're really powerful in this space, they haven't really used that power. Whereas, and a platform like Simulea is for, you know, they're wanting to make money. They're wanting to build business models around this. And so,
yeah, they do have thousands of people working on it versus probably tens or dozens of people at Apple, I guess.
Right. Yeah. So that whole dynamic of, like, who's in control of discovery, I think has sort of pushed the two markets in completely different directions in terms of audio content as well. Because in China, you've got, like, Simulea needs to make profit. Okay, what's the model here? We need to sell set courses, or we need to sell subscriptions. So we need super high quality content. There needs to be a clear value that you're purchasing, right? Like, why would I buy this? Like, if it's just to hear two guys have an interesting conversation, well, that's nice. But
yeah, you don't have a sales pitch, right, for it, right?
But it's probably not going to drive sales the same way as saying, like, Jack Ma is going to be, like, talking, giving all his secrets away, like, on this,
exactly,
on this six-hour lecture.
Yes.
And that will sell like crazy. So that's...
Yeah, so yeah, if you compare those two approaches, it's clear who will win. Like, I mean, in the sense that the market penetration and then the awareness of the... Right? So definitely those platforms will win out.
Yeah. So that's... I find that super interesting that, like, actually... What we're essentially saying is the businesses themselves, like the platforms and the economic dynamics within the market have actually dictated people's listening habits. So, you know, people in China listen to different stuff, and actually the habits of people around consuming audio content are different. And why are they different? They're different because of the platforms and, you know, because of the businesses around it, not because of the people's inherent need to listen to a certain form of content.
But also, I think that culture as well.
Yeah.
I mean, I think plays a really large degree. Maybe not in terms of function. I'm trying to think of the best way to put it. But anyway, culture as well, at least in terms of the actual content itself and why they've been able to monetize it. Right. I mean, the thirst and the hunger, or let's call it the aspirational ambition of so many Chinese people is huge. And, like, that is an extremely lucrative market if you can tap it correctly, right? And so obviously one aspect of that is kind of the luxury market. And so using that as a way to signal status and signal, you know, hey, I've made it. I'm making money or whatever. But then on the other side of that is education. And the education market in China is huge, absolutely enormous. I don't have any numbers in front of me, but you know, my wife works in educational services, and you know, oh my God, there's so much money. Yes. And so, you know, that's the thing. When you look at, you know, all of this audio content, this paid audio content, the reason that it works, the reason that people are willing to pay is because it feeds into that. It gives them the sense that they are learning, that they are improving their life, that they are, I think, Rio, you kind of touched upon it earlier, you know, they're able to show up to some kind of party or social gathering and have something intelligent to say. And I think that's not specifically unique to China, but I think that there is, but it certainly is much more status driven in a lot of senses, I think, than in the US at least. And so I think that that's something that's really important to remember, is that the actual content itself, maybe not necessarily the business model, but the content itself is enabled by that aspirational ambition, and how that aspirational ambition is tied directly into, I think, you know, kind of an Asian propensity to really emphasize education.
Yes, yes, true. That's the traditional traditional force behind all of those, if we put a quote around it, education, because, well, I disagree, some of them are actually education, but let's stop there about the underlying differences. Another thing I want to emphasize is the infrastructure for payments, because it's pretty obvious to the listeners of this show that China is definitely leading in the mobile payment, probably the best in the world. That actually enables a lot of the possibilities, if you think about it. Why are the courses are so popular? Because I can pay like a few bucks in US dollars. I can get to learn a whole month or a whole seasons of the content that I'm interested in for whatever reasons. It will be like the paying procedure will be so smooth that I don't even to think about it anymore, right? Well, with the WeChat red packet money in my WeChat account, I can just pay those like in less than a second. I don't have to think about it. I am proposing, or maybe that for the amateur show, we could actually make use of those, not for the educational quality of the content, maybe just for the entertainment value of the shows will be enough for people to pay for it. For example, if say China Tech Show is available in WeChat, that people can pay say a 1 yuan, which is about like less than 20 cents, dollar cents per episode. How many people do you think would pay for it once they get hooked on it?
Well, the market for English language stuff is small.
Yeah, no, but so. Like if there's an infrastructure to support this small,
sure.
the smooth, what's it called, the tiny, a micro payment, I think the monetization approach will be interesting, right? But you can't do that because you're not in the WeChat ecosystem. Your shows and our shows are on iTunes, which Apple basically says we do nothing here, just to list your shows, and you get the rest of your business running, right? So
yeah, well, and that's the thing about the biggest difference. And again, Connie Chan, I'll go back and I'll find it. She did a great write up. I think that again, as I mentioned before, I think she does muddy the waters in terms of categories, because it's not a 1-to-1 comparison, but it's still really interesting. And so this is the thing. I mean, like podcasting in the West is really difficult to monetize. Matt, you were talking about how, you know, Spotify and Apple, they're trying to do stuff. But, you know, some of the podcasts that I listen to, they talk about this every once in a while, and they're very skeptical of the kind of business potential of podcast networks and podcasts themselves. You know, like you and I, we have some other podcasters that we know that are trying to monetize and trying to make the podcast part of their multiple revenue streams. But it's one of those things, like, it's never going to support their entire lifestyle. I mean, like, you know, podcasts like Joe Rogan, for example, where we're talking of like millions of downloads each episode, that is very monetizable. But once you get into the long tail of kind of shows like ours, where we're looking at, you know, thousands of downloads, that it's very different. And so the, and the big issue, of course, is like the great thing about like programmatic and online advertising is that it's very trackable. It's very traceable. You can see if someone actually converted into an actual paying customer and so on and so on. With podcasting, at least with where the technology is right now, it's basically impossible to do all of that. Apple is trying to build out this this backend, this analytics backend, but you know, it's like too little, too late, guys. I mean, no one uses the podcast app. I mean, not anyone actually serious about about listening to podcasts, at least, because the UX is absolutely horrible.
I do.
Do you really?
Yeah, I do.
Oh, I'm sorry to hear that.
Yeah, no, because actually I want to be on the same app that most of my listeners use.
Yeah, that makes sense.
So basically what you just described is very, is pretty accurate description of the current market. But I'm thinking maybe we could do better. Well, if the micropayments problem can be solved in the for your shows, I mean, in the Western internet infrastructure, because right now you don't, right? There's credit card infrastructure, but it's not really geared or optimized for micropayments. Well, maybe Facebook's Libra might fix it, but they have a long way to go before the regulation can actually approve it. But if we assume that direct monetization is possible versus indirect monetization by like placing ads, the long tail shows might have a chance. If you really think about it, if you have like say 10,000 paying subscribers, each paying you a $1 a month, you can actually support many of the long tail shows, I guess.
Oh, for sure. I think there's people experimenting with models around that. Yeah, like a premium show. Right. I think in the West, that stuff is starting to take traction. So you have a basic show and then you have extra content that's meant to be of a higher quality, or, you know, maybe it's same quality, but like extra. Your general point's totally correct, though, Ri. I mean, like, it's mobile payments and having that, like, not being able to just don't need to think about making a transaction and it being so seamless is a big deal. And, fact that the take from businesses on for credit cards is relatively high. You know, you have a credit card fee that's fairly high for a transaction online. Something like PayPal, for example, the rates that they take is an order of magnitude higher than it is in China for something like Alipay.
Yeah, when I used to do membership in my first podcast, we used Stripe to collect the payments. And payments usually are in the very low single-digit dollar amount. On average, Stripe takes about, let's say, 20 to 30% of the revenue. It's actually probably like what Apple takes in the App Store model, right? So it's difficult. But if we do the same thing right now, let's say on WeChat through the WeChat payment or Alipay, we can recoup most of the revenue, and it will be much smoother. The barrier of entry for paying customers will be much lower as well. Because remember, for you to use PayPal, to use PayPal or even Stripe, you have to have a credit card, or basically a Visa debit card, something like that. Which means you have to be what's called banked in the United States. Which surprisingly is not that universal, right? So this is also a difference between the US and China, because in China, banking is basically universal. Everybody can have a free bank account in the banks in China, because that's a financial regulation there. You can't charge people for their only bank account there. And with a bank account, you can get into the WeChat payment ecosystem and you're set, right? So the difference the US takes is, I think, from now will be diverge. China will be more about, let's say in China, the direct payment and direct monetization and indirect monetization will be kind of equally important, versus in the States, you probably have to rely on indirect monetization, basically ads, for the majority of the income, which is quite unfortunate, because ads are not suitable for the long tails.
Exactly. But I guess we should start wrapping it up. All right. Well, Rio, thanks so much for taking the time to join us. You know, I have to say that from my end, and this has been an extremely enjoyable conversation. You know, it's always nice to be able to talk with someone who is exercising a very similar craft as we are here. But it's also because you are Chinese and you're doing something similar, but for a Chinese audience, I think, you know, there's a lot of really interesting discussion. And unfortunately, we have to end it here because we don't want to go on for too long. But certainly we do hope to have you back on the show in the future.
Thank you very much. I'm very glad to be here. And a really long time follower of your show anyway.
Well, thanks.
I'll be back.
And so before we do go, if anyone wants to find you online, where should they do that?
You can follow me for the foreign, for non-Chinese audience. You can follow me on Twitter at RioJot, RioJot. That's my Twitter handle. You can also, if you read Chinese, you can go to my Zhihu page. I can put my link in the show notes. Also, if you can listen Chinese, you will come to listen to my shows.
Perfect. And we'll include all of those links in the show notes. And to our listeners, if you enjoyed this episode, we'd really appreciate it if you gave us a review on iTunes. It helps us to get discovered and pushes up further up into the ranks. And if you're not on iTunes or not on the podcast app, you can go to Overcast or Pocket Cast, tap on that star button, and it will recommend this podcast to your network.